Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And tonight we're going to go back to a book that I really enjoyed. And it's called The A Toltec's Path. Or rather, A Toltec Path. And it was written by Ken Eaglefeather. And it's of course, for those of you, we've done a number of them. You can look into our more recent archives over the last 6 months or so. And we've done a number of shows on this book. I think at least three or four other programs. So, and where we left off was chapter four. And I was hoping to, I wanted to jump to chapter four. To the part two of this book, I don't think I'll get to that tonight, which was really chapter five, but it's called The Seer. And as I was going through this, I have to thank George Dixon again for introducing me to some of these books. I've read these in some of these, for instance, The Eagle's Gift many years ago, and I misplaced the book. And, of course, I've forgotten a lot of what was in it. Going through it again today, getting ready for this show, I realized the where the significance of how this Toltec message or religion of sorcery, actually, it's one of sorcery, but more so than that, it's. I mean, there are demonic elements to any religion. I mean, we recognize evil and demonic existences, just as angelic and existences in these works. But primarily, I guess I want to focus on tonight is this path of fourth dimensional existence that we must achieve or we do achieve eventually to achieve. And as we get toward the 2012 merge, if you will, the zero point merge aspect of our evolution, we're supposed to be able to transcend our consciousness into a fourth dimensional state. It's coming, you know. But and that's basically what the Toltecs, you know, have practiced over the many years through their work. And transcending time and space, transcending this dimension, this third dimensional existence. And in the gift, or the Eagle's Gift, which was the Castaneda's first book, he discusses, and I was considering reading that chapter tonight, but they discuss the what they call leaving the human form or leaving the human body. You know, you see from a different. In fact, I should have written it down, but I wanted to get the exact quote here. Leaving the body, basically. And letting go of our fourth dimension or third dimensional perspectives, and beginning to see the world see things from a different perspective, from a spiritual perspective, but one from another dimension, a more plasmic dimension, one of less focus on a specific detail, things, if you will, more focus on the essence of existence, what we are, and how we detect these things, and how it's done. And, you know, we become seers, right? And the seers of that fourth dimensional existence, if you will. And I wanted to get into this. Eagle Feather is a guide to the teachings of Don Juan Matus and Carlos Castaneda, and the Toltec seers. And he does a very, very good job, I felt, in as a guidebook to this work. And I wanted to, as we developed into the Toltec team, that's just chapter 4 of this book, discuss how in the Toltec tradition they use teams of people, and there's a merge of thought, but they see, and they see together, right? They see this dimensional change together. They see things together. And because the powers that be that are used to allow us to allow the seers to or the practitioners of the Toltec tradition to transcend, all right, the third dimensional state, as well as fourth, fifth, I guess, and so on, because it seems endless. In its power, but the mystery of it essentially centers around, or part of the power centers around, a team that Castaneda became part of, of initiates. Okay, and Don Juan Moltec, who was the Nagu, or the teacher of these people. A leader actually gave Castaneda passed on that information to Castaneda. But what happened with Castaneda is that he realized that early on he needed these people, because he was supposed to be a leader, but he didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to lead. He didn't know what he was, you know, supposed to do, even though he had all this grand information and was taught these great and marvelous secrets. This pathway, but and in the Eagle's Gift is when he meets with all of these people and creates his leadership, if you will, in the group. But to explain this a little more, and how these groups are derived and how they are created. Eagle Feather, Ken Eagle Feather, says that in Chapter 4, he calls it the Toltec Team. And over the years, I've associated with Toltecs scattered about the United States, Mexico, Canada, and Europe. They consist of men and women, with some of each gender oriented to tracking and to dreaming. Diverse in ages, preferences, tastes, styles, backgrounds, and abilities, their common bond is an unrelenting quest for freedom. As such, they reflect the personalities of a Nagul's party, as outlined in Chapter 9 and 10 of Castaneda's book, The Eagle, The Eagle's Gift. Okay. And the profile of the Nagul's party, or what I refer to as the Toltec team, is an aspect of the rule. Toltecs use the rule as energy for stability and growth, not for mindless adherence. Thus, there can be individual interpretations within its overall scope. Plus, not every team needs to mirror another. There are plenty of room for variations while implementing the overall theme. The guiding light is for each member to deal with that actually unfolds, rather than forcing compliance with preconceived notions. In turn, each team must find its own way, and pressures and requirements change with time and locale. While guided by the rule, this chapter then is based on my observation of and my interaction with these people. the sexes. Donner states that males and females relate to reason differently. These These differences, she says, make females more flexible. Don Juan says that while men possess sobriety and purpose, females have the talent. He adds that due to their nature, women have a marked edge over men in the general pursuit of knowledge. This kind of thinking blows most 20th century models out the window. But it is also interesting that this division of labor is consistent with archetypes of masculine and feminine energies. Masculine energy is thought to provide direction and thrust. Feminine energy is often considered open, pliable, and nurturing. It is also important to note that males and females are generally regarded as having both masculine and feminine energies. Donner extends Don Juan's thinking about women by saying that our survival as a species depends on giving women time to evolve. Rather than align with procreation, she feels women need to align with evolution. By using the womb, a dreaming organ, she says that the dream of another intent, another reality, may be latched onto and expressed. One effect would be leading the entire species in another direction, from which women would give birth to another species. This is not leadership in the traditional sense. It is leadership in radical transformation. There is no question that in recent history, male perspectives have ruled. We have few monuments to women. We have relatively few female political representatives. Thus, it's obvious that our society has refused to recognize the validity of their views and their power. Now, however, women have had their fill and seek to claim their freedom. There is even a growing discourse on patriarchal versus matriarchal societies. Quite often I hear that patriarchal societies are contriving, power-dominated, and subversive of human rights. Matriarchal societies, on the other hand, are viewed as embracing, nurturing, and protective of the highest ideals. A concurrent theme is that patriarchal societies, hence men in general, don't have the comprehensive view women do. Men are deemed to harbor natural limitations. This view often becomes implicit, not needing expression, and therefore the flip side of the drive for domination surfaces. This time by women. Women who exhibit this attitude arbitrarily and systematically demean men. By doing so, women commit the very grievance which they wish to correct. For instance, I remember a kitchen table conversation with a friend where one woman spoke endearingly of her affiliation with the sisterhood. This connection provided strength and help to her focus her resolve toward liberation. One of the men spoke of how he felt the same way toward men, and he sought to encourage their evolution and their empowerment. He spoke of men capitalizing on the women's liberation movement in order to better free themselves. And the women said it was too bad. He just couldn't see people as people, not as sexes. So while it was fine to espouse virtues of sisterhood, like-minded male activity was seen as boys being boys. Now, her remark does carry great meaning. However, for a time, men were considered by many as superior, the breadwinners. Now, a growing number of women are superior. Women are superior, and the saviors. Perhaps the pendulum needs to swing in the opposite direction to generate more awareness and balance. And perhaps humans simply seek to dominate. However, we can even step beyond patriarchal and matriarchal concerns. Perhaps if we find a common ground of equality, we can move on to a higher ground. And as Don Juan says, the fact that we all face death makes us all equal, leaving us no time for anything else. Using this advice as a guide, perhaps we can elevate ourselves beyond the so-called battle of the sexes and into the rhythms of universal consciousness, where the drama of masculine and feminine energy is but a stage play. I don't know if I'm going to go. For some reason, I believe I think I read this. I don't know if I read this on the air. The four directions. The rule divides individuals into four groups or directions, north, east, south, and west. The directions reflect the natural balance of orienting oneself on a path. Furthermore, each direction embodies a particular intent. Arguments of male or female superiority aside, a defining Toltec view is that women carry within them the intention, the intent of the directions. By their nature, women are therefore connected with intent, whereas men must learn to make the connection. It is this deference that led Don Juan to give women an edge in pursuing knowledge. The following categories reflect form of energy. The idea here is not to define types of behavior as much as it is to direct awareness into another frame of reference. North. This direction concerns itself with knowledge. A person from this direction seeks and gains highly specific knowledge in a particular area of inquiry. It is the intent of the scholar. While vital to almost any endeavor, North inhabitants often carry an aloof, domineering arrogance. Resting too comfortably within their domain, they are easily blinded to the unknown and thus run into trouble by a reluctance to continually break the boundaries of their current knowledge. As we understand that, the academics, you know, certain thought, science, and so on, that are blinded to criticism or alternative thinking. The East, optimism and humor bubble forth from this intent. Often having gentle dispositions, people with this orientation make perfect messengers and scouts. Although a little fickle, they eventually scout the road in front of you, making sure you don't run into something you'd rather avoid. An east-oriented person usually requires direction from without. Excuse me. They need instigation. But once in motion, are more than up to the task. South. A very nurturing, soothing direction, as though sealed in a protective cocoon. This person's energy body automatically produces a sheen which shields them from the seeing of others. It is harder to see into them and their motives than it is to see into the other directions. This makes them suitable for behind-the-scenes work. For example, this person enjoys the control derived from getting a political aspirant into office rather than personally seeking the office. And West, power. Those centered within the direction are prone to action, doing instead of talking. They possess a very aggressive demeanor. Their raw energy provides fuel for propulsion into almost any endeavor. However, they also tend to be volatile, boisterous, and contemptuous. And the natural power lurking within continually challenges their sense of balance with the other directions. And I have a tendency to be Northwest, if it can be that way, I guess. I sometimes have become far too rigid in my thinking, but at the same time, I don't know. Perhaps in my normal quest for, you know, power just to live and exist, we possess a very aggressive demeanor. I have a tendency to be aggressive, especially as a liberal radio talk show host and a political talk show host. And and I see this in me. I see the raw energy fuel for propulsion. But anyway, this can be a negative trait. The following chart offers male and female perspectives regarding the four directions. It offers views on orientation and function, plus a positive and negative trait of each. Again, it is to provide perspective, not to confine behavior. Direction type, general function, positive trait, and negative trait. This is the females. As the males, females tend to be these are just the functions I just talked about. Okay, north, south, east, west. These are not exclusive categories. Other descriptions of the directions may fit just as well. Also, I find a typical reaction is, oh, but I am all of those. Right? Correct. We all have each direction within us, including male and female perspectives. Yet some people are moody, timid, or aggressive. Some are marked tendencies towards scholarly work, arts, crafts, or human services. And the directions serve only to account for different temperaments, not limit us to them. For example, a southern direction does not preclude action, just as an action-prone person is not excluded from refined knowledge. It doesn't mean males can't be conceited or females can't be manipulative. The direction also provides a model so we may accept variations in others, as well as understand how different personalities influence us. For instance, north-directed people may use well-crafted authoritative arguments as a subterfuge to cover the fact that they don't see at all that well, that they don't I also know self-directed Toltecs who are result of their nurturing bents carry with them and inflict upon others their pervasive understanding that they know best. And some of what they consider nurturing is just an attempt to bend others to their wishes. Rather than get in an uproar over these kind of excesses, it is sometimes easier to tolerate their behavior by placing their individual tendencies into a larger context. Moreover, we can use the element of each direction to measure our strengths and weaknesses. By understanding various components of our personalities, we stand a better chance to integrate and balance the energies of each, making us better equipped to get on with the task. Trackers and dreamers. There are many facets to tracking and dreaming. In a manner, dreaming is awareness and tracking is a discipline to harness awareness. Both are necessary. As with the directions, we all carry both. Yet people usually lean toward one or the other as a matter of predilection or inherent self-nature. Those who lean toward tracking or trackers tend to fare better in ordinary human endeavors, while those who lean toward dreaming or dreamers find a natural home in worlds beyond the ordinary. Trackers are usually down-to-earth, grounded in practical views of self and world. They are amenable and adaptable. They easily focus their energy toward order and stability. After all, tracking is the skill of stabilizing perception. Trackers offer a team balance and support because they are at ease in dealing with the consensus. They can also enter, use, and leave a social order with minimal difficulty, as they ardently groom their knowledge of social interactions. However, they often lack raw imagination. While their discipline is essential for growth, our continued growth, their stability hinders dramatic ventures into the unknown. They have the ability to tackle the unknown, but lack the orientation and energy to enter it most elusive regions, as do dreamers. Perhaps due to their affinity with other worlds, dreamers may have had a hard time with earthly discipline. Their sense of order tends to come from how they relate to external authority. This gives them something to latch onto. They therefore tend towards fixations. However, in an attempt to internalize their sense of order, dreamers then envision that the world accurately reflects their thoughts. They often grab on to one or two pieces of evidence and then get lost along those lines of thought. Then they may expand their dreaming to think other others share the same dreams and thus have the same values and views. With their intense energy, this tendency has the effect of pulling others into their web-like dreams. Their fixations prevent adaptability and measured direct growth. As a result, strength and stability supplied from a consistent external source is required to penetrate this barrier. Not always making solid connections between their inner world and what's occurring outside, and dreamers offer a team workouts in abrupt energetic change. And that's why, you know, you have to be very careful in so many ways as to what you believe and don't believe, and then how you can stay centered and not become a heel bopper, you know, or whatever, and a member of some crazy cult that, you know, can do harm to you and others. And from what I see and from what I've understood so far in my learning here, is that the Toltec path is one it seems to be a group effort, but it can also be a very personal effort and a very private one at the same time. And we take from this from what Don Juan has stated, that or Castaneda has stated actually, that the Toltec path is a team effort. It takes a team to create a greater awareness, a greater path. But each one, or each individual, is then evolves along his own unique path as well, and the team helps him achieve that path, or helps each one. Each other achieve that goal, which is freedom, which is enlightenment, which is knowledge, which is power, you know, self-knowledge and awareness, and the ability to shape-shift, the ability to transcend this reality to another, from this dimension to another dimension. It shows you the pathway to do that. And it's a complicated method, and it's not one to be taken lightly. But in this introductory program, what I'm trying to do is at least create an awareness to the listener that not only does this exist, but that it's used, and there are many people that are very much involved with this, the use of sorcery and shape shifting, and some for the good and others for evil. As again, but in its own right, it's no different than any religion. Yeah, or any secret school. I mean, you can use it for the good of man, or use it for, you know, your own personal benefit, you know, and for the and for evil purposes, you know, that kind of thing. And it gets pretty much I guess when I first studied this many, many years ago, back in the early 80s, I guess, maybe even before then, when I first came across Castaneda's work, I was more or less frightened by it. I was more surprised by it, and I couldn't really, I wasn't at a point of maturity really recognize the totality of what he was stating, or the whole concept. And I, like everybody else, not everybody else, but many, many others, many people who became introduced to this was from the, from his use of drugs, okay, marijuana, mushrooms, hallucinogenics, peyote, these other things, and he introduced those drugs, or I shouldn't say introduced them, but gave recognition to those drugs that were being used throughout the 60s and 70s by many who were into mind-expanding experiments. But he brought these things to the forefront. But what he failed to do, or what I shouldn't say he failed to do, because he didn't fail himself, but what his followers, many of his followers, failed to do is go further than the fourth cycle, which is the introduction of medicinal plants, and psychedelic plants, and so on. So that's the unfortunate aspect of this. That also is the path of that must be examined much more carefully. In the sense that you can reach these altered states and these altered dimensions through psychotropic drugs, but you cannot psychedelic drugs, and but that's not really the whole thing. That's how people got lost. That's how people got destroyed. That's how the people burned themselves down. And they're still out there running around thinking that, dropping mescaline and peyote, thinking that that's the way to go. But in some ways it is, but it allows one to reach that fourth dimensional level with ease. But again, being somewhat of a tracker in my makeup, I like to believe there's also the I'll die in here if I do that. Anyway, that's the essence of what I'm saying. Knowing the intricacies of systems helps accomplish this maneuver. Thus, while Toltecs study and implement the rule to enhance perceptions, seers examine the ins and outs of perception itself. Just as the seers from other traditions have their guiding lights, the Toltecs, a variety of seers, use the rule as a reference to get on with the mission. In this light, the next section explores influences shaping perception and examines underpinnings of a Toltec seer's knowledge. And I'm going to go into that now. This is chapter 5, or part 2 of the book, and chapter 5 begins with the seer. The shape of things to come. A worldview is a principal force in shaping perception. By participating within a worldview, we gradually align our energies with the world. As a result, we actively condition ourselves to what we can and cannot perceive. As with anything else, there are costs and benefits. On the high side, by fashioning a worldview, we have a world to view. The downside is that we tend to expand our snapshot into ultimate truth, thereby leaving other worlds out of the picture. Consequently, we readily cast aside new or opposing views, since they challenge what we hold dear. And we do that all the time. But worldview is not truth. It is technique. It helps us make sense of our experiences and allows us to interact with the world better. A worldview stems from binding together a host of elements, such as Earth's revolution around the sun, the nature of gravity, and views of God. A worldview guides our way. The energy placed behind it directs our thoughts, feelings, and experiences. Hence, it embodies and consumes a great amount of power. If it is a solid, well-constructed view, our experience matches it. This gives us a world to use. However, if it also generates a huge self-fulfilling prophecy that limits what we see to its own boundaries, and this is a problem as well. How many times do we say that, no, what we believe, what we say, oh, this would be wonderful if this were true, but we're only looking at it from a very minute perspective in that what would it mean to others and where, what, you know, what would it mean to the rest of the world? What would it mean to, you know, to whatever, you know? We know it might benefit us, but would it benefit that other individual, or would it benefit many, or what is the collective thought here? So, let me go on. But worldview is not truth. We already said that. This power rests in consciousness, in consensus, social agreements which bind together personal energies. These agreements produce an implicit contract from which we dogmatically determine what is real or not real. Due to the complexity of a complete worldview, a vast amount of consensus typically rests below conscious recognition. We then assume that a reality is real. However, no worldview is all-inclusive, and none can account for the sum total of creation. Existence is simply too vast. Moreover, or therefore, knowledge of how worldviews influence perception is important because of their power to limit or to expand perception. This chapter focuses on a few influences which shape our perception and thus determine what is to come. Ordinary and non-ordinary worlds. Any worldview is a coherent set of assumptions about reality. These assumptions are simply points of view, dots in front of our eyes. Even though we each have a distinct relation to the world, we share common tendencies. Excuse me. Culture, geographic environment, and the connections which result merely from being human all work together to provide a consistency of perception. This consistency gives us the ability to communicate and to effectively interact with others. Generally speaking, an ordinary reality focuses on the physical world, and a non-ordinary reality brings into play other, often unseen dimensions. Whether you are building an ordinary or a non-ordinary world, the process of building remains the same. For instance, during the early stages of my apprenticeship, I found no apparent consistency in the Toltec world. The new language enabled a shared outlook between Don Juan and me hadn't been developed. And over several years, however, I worked with the techniques of different non-ordinary disciplines, including Zen, Taoism, but primarily Toltec. And this work slowly expanded my worldview, and I gradually developed the ability to communicate with other Toltecs. In a like manner, from birth, we are taught the views and practices of ordinary reality. By employing these, we gain membership in that world. Ordinary worlds tightly embrace the known and the familiar. Extending awareness into the unknown occurs slowly. While conducting experiments, an experimenter's worldview creates the boundaries of the experiment in terms of what can and cannot be tested. The conditions of what is allowed to exist determine what will exist, and this capacity for distortion is referred to as experimenter bias or experimenter effect. This bias affects not only what takes place during the experiment, but also how the experiment is evaluated. One difficulty with testing for psychic phenomena, for instance, is that experimenters often start from negative assumptions. Many scientists simply do not acknowledge psychic function. Worse yet, many do not allow for its possibility. To them, the term of their world indicates it doesn't exist, and so they build that assumption into their tests. Sometimes this bias produces even more complicated effects. For instance, say an experiment is to test if a person can have an out-of-body experience. And during the experiment, the subject travels away from her body and perceives six numbers. I gotta close the window. It started to pour. I lost my spot here, I'm sorry. During the a person can have an out-of-body experience. And during the experiment, the subject travels away from her body and perceives six numbers written on a piece of paper in another building. She returns to her body and correctly gives the experimenter the numbers as well as the layout of the other building. Critics who once said psychic ability doesn't exist might now say it was not her dreaming body, but some other form of psychic occurrence. As you might imagine, the manner of building reality takes a long time. Impeccably proving or disproving the results of others is a hallmark of the scientific method. Its rigorous nature offers strength. However, when you're aiming for the fire from within, relying on social consensus proves too tedious, too time-consuming. And without sacrificing diligence, Toltecs step up the pace of their investigations. Using a non-ordinary worldview is one way to move the process along faster. For example, the dreaming body, various forms of seeing, and elements and elementals are typically pre-established components of our non-ordinary worlds. Thus, if a person remembers his dreaming body, he won't be discounted as some kind of dream aberration. Or if a person expectedly sees an elemental spirit, it won't be chalked up as imagination. In general, non-ordinary views offer less constriction on awareness. And so you don't require a longer amount of time to validate an unusual experience. Non-ordinary worlds also assist in expanding ordinary worlds, and dreaming abilities such as levitation or entering other dimensions act as scouts, as forerunners for expanding a reality's boundaries. Dreaming energy impacts ordinary reality and gradually aligns it with the greater options found in non-ordinary worlds. Contemporary law of interplanetary travel, for example, fall away as pure understanding grows. Where once researchers might think physical objects can surpass the speed of light, they gradually recondition themselves to other potentials. They might then begin thinking about the notion of hyperspace and where current laws of travel are thought to evaporate. Their new thinking then aligns more of their energy with developing a technology that permits interdimensional and therefore extended interplanetary travel. And I'm going to read a little more. But, you know, is it simply expanding your mind, for crying out loud? You got to go beyond the parameters of your great, 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 great grandfathers, although some of them probably had a greater imagination than the people do today. But, you know, I always marvel at people who refuse to, people who don't believe in a fourth dimensional existence, even though they'll believe in Christ, or they'll believe in the Christhood, or they'll believe in they have no clue what it actually means. Transcending the spirit, transcending the human body. Where do we go? That's fourth dimensional existence. That's fifth dimensional, sixth dimensional, seventh dimensional. And yeah, these are hierarchies that exist, that we all know exist, but we refuse to accept. Logical reality, whereas logical reality, some people say, hey, when you die, you die, you're dead. Believe that you're, and the Bible says, from dust to dust, you know, that kind of thing, you know, so, but if you believe that, then what a grim and hopeless life this is. You have to have a higher truth. And the Toltec path is just one way, and there are so many other ways to establishing that grand vision of a fourth dimensional existence. And I'm constantly looking into things and trying to perceive life from a topographical, if you will, approach. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to do that, but I find that it's good. I have to see the world as an eagle sees the world, you know. Flying up and over the third dimensional obstacles and having clear and focused vision, so clear I can pick out something, a mile below me. But to be able to see the world from a completely global perspective, and I mean that both politically as well as humanitarianly, that makes any sense, humanly, and philosophically, putting it all together and being able to look from a topographical outlook, and that you can see the whole world beneath you. And you see the mountains and the valleys and the people and the houses and the everything. I mean, you're just flying over it. You're looking at it, you're perceiving it from sitting right here. We can perceive and see those things. We can project these visions in our mind just from transcending our own body, transcending our own thoughts. Remote viewing is constantly happening. People have that knowledge on how to do that. Shape-shifting, taking on another shape, seeing life from another perspective. Animal, human, or, whatever it may be. But these are all established paths. But again, they're all established paths which have their own problems, their own dark areas that we must avoid. And I think we were, most of us, not all of us, but most of us were created with common sense. Rational thinking mind, that perceives the world for what it is and can be, and also understands the value of the imagination, the value of thought, and the displacement. That's what differs from us from the animal world, is our ability to see the future, predict the future, see ourselves in the future, of where we would like to be, where we'd want to be, where we will be. And because of that, we have that great power. And this power is the power that we talk about in the Toltec Bow. More so in the sense that we gain power, personal power, as well as a collective power when we follow these paths of knowledge to where we expand our own limited views, our own limited horizons, and understand that the world is the world and is merely merely a holographic image, if you will, of a greater mind, a greater concept. If you believe in a creator, which I personally do, then you have to believe that we are the world, and every creature within it is here for a purpose to either replenish, feed, or inspire, or diminish, or whatever it is that they're providing an existence for. I don't know. I mean, very, very difficult to explain to one who is not on a journey, who doesn't understand the pathways to hasn't pursued those pathways and has a very concrete and consequential existence. Black, white, this, that. And in many ways, it must be a dreamer in order to be able to comprehend these mystical and miraculous miraculous knowledge, and if be able to grasp that fourth dimensional existence and higher in the hierarchy of dimensions, in order that is part of our evolutionary process. Where many people will just say, "Oh, that's bull. There's no evolutionary process. You're born, you die, and that's it." People who want to believe in going to heaven or hell or whatever, that's part of their own imagination. That's part of their own existence that they have in their lives. I personally just believe that, whatever is there is very, very different than what's here. And in the future is of our making in many ways. But there are limitations as to how far man can go before he goes down, before he starts to disintegrate morally, physically, mentally. And it's up to that individual to instill temperance in their lives, prudence, caution. But that caution is brought about by learning more and more and more, understanding these difficult nuances, if you will, or understanding these difficult pathways that were designed to lighten and engage us into easing our transition to the fourth dimension, or enlightenment, or to the altar world, and that exists. But it exists for only those who are willing to search and seek out and work toward the understanding of that. And what I enjoy most in my life was learning. I just enjoy learning and the knowledge, acquiring knowledge and being able to utilize that knowledge to advance my own personal journey, if you will, my own spiritual and physical well-being. And that's what knowledge does. Not only does it allow you to become, it allows you to be more skeptical, but it also allows you to be more authoritative in your beliefs. The more, it's like somebody said, in fact, I have the book, this guy who did personal, wrote a book on personal branding, publicity. He stated that if a person has read 5 books on one subject, he is considered an expert. Just 5 books on one subject, the person has done, actually it could be, is considered an expert in that area. So, I mean, when you think that 5 books is virtually nothing, but how many people have read 5 books in one specific area? It's hard to say, you know. Most people read nonfiction. Most people read fiction. So fiction creates no valid knowledge, really. It's just fiction, you know. It's like somebody creates like Harry Potter or something. You know, it's like, creates nothing. Whereas nonfiction is a valid documentation of what happened, of reality, and tries to create a journalistic as well as a an integrity and a record of a record that has integrity and will hold up to scrutiny and it will hold up to lies and deceit and political manipulations and revisions. Nonfiction, good written nonfiction, is reality. It's real. It's what happened. It's what's happening. And and that's more or less what I read, that and books like this and metaphysics. But I see metaphysics from a standpoint of nonfiction as well. It's an exercise, a mind-expanding exercise, and which allows us all to, allows its readers and students to experience a far greater understanding of the world around them and the multitude of possibilities that exist rather than the one-dimensional treaties that are offered by your standard religions or your standard governmental and academic tribunals of thought tribunals, you know. So I'm trying to manipulate the information, you know, to manipulate, you know, those the people. You know, if you tell a person that he's an ass, and you tell him that enough, he'll start believing it. You know. So about himself or about someone else, and that becomes historical fact as we know it. So anyway. We're just about out of time. I want to thank everybody who joined me tonight. And, Rand, if you can get a copy of this, I don't know if it's out of print. It was published it was published by Hampton Roads Publishing Company back in 1995. So you might want to check it out. And it's called A Toltec Path by Ken Eaglefeather. And I want to thank everybody for joining me. And join us tomorrow night with George Dixon, Friday night with George Dixon, and I believe Lila will be with us. And I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Tomorrow night we'll be talking, I believe, about the Mayan calendar, the timeline, and so forth. And good night.